Ladies and gentlemen, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not gonna drink stale grocery store coffee anymore! Nope, that's right, because I've switched to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug roasts your beans when you order, then delivers it right to your door anywhere in Canada within days. They've got roasts and grinds to suit any taste, including a rotating special blend for those of you who, like me, like to switch it up. Forget your local hipster coffee joint. It's time for your favorite coffees to start coming from your own kitchen. Get started today at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey gang, and thanks so much for tuning into the podcast that looks back at the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 list of the greatest American motion pictures. We warn you now about spoilers, so don't get mad as hell if we ruin the surprises. I am Ryan Ellis with my cohort in the television business, legitimately cohort in the television business, my wife Bev.
Thank you, Mr. Beale.
I must make my witness.
Yes, sir, Mr. Beale.
All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's film, it is network and required a spoiler alert, so here we go. Continuing a recent AFI theme, the main, or at least a main character, is shot dead in network. What's the next AFI film where the main man, or woman, is shot and killed? And by the way, there are some debatable choices here, but I'm looking for one movie in particular. You had to know what I was thinking. Read my mind, lady!
Okay, I'm going way ahead. Is it Sixth Sense?
You're a little too far.
Yeah? What is it?
Well, I think debatably you could say Platoon.
Oh, okay.
And don't forget, these are spoiler alerts now. So Tom Berenger, but he's not the main. It's Charlie Sheen who's the main. Goodfellas, you got Joe Pesci.
But Hank Hill is the lead.
Hank Hill. Better known as Henry Hill.
Close enough.
Not the guy from King of the Hill.
Right. Look. I don't have your steel trap memory today, it's okay.
But yes, Pesci is a supporting character. And then Unforgiven, Gene Hackman, big star, won the supporting actor Oscar.
But not the lead.
No. Yeah. So, it's Pulp Fiction, John Travolta, Gun Down by Bruce Willis.
Again, a little debatable because it's an ensemble.
He's top billed, though.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. But not that long before Sixth Sense, only 5-6 years.
That's right. Well, you know, one of the reasons we do these coming attractions questions is to mention other movies that are coming up. It's kind of a way of promoting the podcast from the future. And I thought Pulp Fiction was the right answer until I looked further, and I thought, oh, God, there's all these other debatable ones. Well, now we've promoted all kinds of great movies. Many of them are rated films, including this one, which is the Top 100 Project's 94th film, Network. And it was 66th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 between Thrillers, The Silence of the Lambs, and The Manchurian Candidate. Then crawled up a little bit to 64th in 2007 between Cabaret and The African Queen. MGM and United Artists premiered Network on November 14th, 1976, then released it on November 27th. The film sold lots of tickets. And Bev will describe the film for you now with The Skinny.
Peter Finch is Howard Beale, the news anchor of a fictional New York television station who's told he's being fired because of low ratings. His response? He's going to kill himself on the air. That comment and further madcap behavior wins viewers, but Howard quickly goes right off the deep end. Faye Dunaway is Diana Christensen, an unscrupulous TV executive who tangles with William Holden's news director, Max Schumacher.
Or in a nutshell, newsman says he's going to die on the air, then he does. Or Fox News circa 1976. All right, the stats are at the top. So, Rotten Tomatoes critics, 91% of them liked it, 48 fresh, 5 rotten, and 93% of audiences. That just changed the day we record this podcast. It lost 1 percentage point. It was 94 when I looked before that. And it was nowhere near the top 10 of the 1976 U.S. box office. Rocky was far and away numero uno. How about Bev's thoughts, though, about a movie that we can relate to more than most?
Yeah, it doesn't hurt that you and I both work in television, so we're, like, custom-made to enjoy this film, which is pure pleasure. It's hilarious, it's smart, it's frenetic, it's tight as a drum. There's some stuff to criticize. It's definitely indulgent, and you kind of have to forgive its smugness, but whatever. I could watch Faye Dunaway as Diana Christensen all day, every day. This movie's a blast.
I think my favorite part of her whole performance is a look she gives when either Holden or Duvall, I forget who it is now, asks her something about being unscrupulous, as we just said she is, and she gives a look like, yep, I'll do that.
She has that amazing, unbridled enthusiasm for everything, and it's probably the thing that makes her endearing because she's such a truly bad character. Everything about her is detestable, But her love for her job is what keeps her just likable enough to not become a boring, you know, mustache-twirling villain.
And didn't quite make the top 100 heroes and villains list, but she was nominated, at least.
You know, she's a villain, but really the worst thing that she does is she just says what everybody can't say. She openly states
and leads the charge.
That's true. She leads the charge, but she knows that what everybody truly cares about is ratings and money and how much money you can get for the ad shares of a program. And she just says it out loud and reacts with enthusiasm when something's going to succeed in the manner that everybody really wants it to succeed, but nobody really wants to admit that they want ratings. They want ad share.
And her boss is Robert Duvall. How many times now have we seen him? Is this the fifth? Yes, the fifth time.
Yeah.
Mockingbird in 62, the two Godfather films, MASH, and this is five, and then Apocalypse Now is his sixth film. Here he's got more power than in most movies, and probably more screen time than the other movies, including the Godfather films. He's transparent. He's a money guy. He's doing whatever they want just to get ahead. So he does a good job. Duvall's good in the movie, but he's not all that deep. He's culpable in what they do with Howard Beale, and so is she, of course.
Oh, yeah.
But William Holden might be the key character in the whole film, because he's Howard's friend, and there's more than one time in this movie he has a chance to do the right thing, and he stays with it. He doesn't resign when he has a chance to. Well, he tries to, and then it's pushed back in his face. Now, we need you to stay here. I don't know how much power he has to say that Howard's not going to go on the air. He could just say, I'm going to resign rather than you torture my friend and also turn this into a circus. And he does say those words, but doesn't really stick with it either. So as bad as Diana is, as bad as Duvall's Frank Hackett character is, Max, I don't think he's a villain, but he's the one who knows better, and even he keeps on torturing this poor guy who is losing his mind. And I'm going to be very careful about calling him crazy and dismissing that, because I said last week in All the President's Men, we shouldn't just throw people under the bus because they're crazy.
Him coming unhinged is kind of less a sympathetic portrayal of mental illness and more a plot device,
though. Well, yes, because he is, as Henry Fonda said, a guy who could have had this role, hysterical. That's why Henry Fonda, who worked with Sidney Lumet, the director, on 12 Angry Men, a movie that they both loved. Here was a chance to do this character that would get him all kinds of notes. It's not that he wasn't already a big famous star. And he turned it down for those reasons. Gene Hackman turned it down. Jimmy Stewart. Can you imagine Jimmy Stewart?
Well, you know, I want you to get mine. Listen there. You raise up your window and then you...
The whole speech would have taken 10 minutes to get through.
Yeah.
And then George C. Scott and probably a lot of other people. But those four names. What different actors? Hackman, Scott, Stewart, and Fonda. But they went with the English, Peter Finch, who wasn't in any other AFI films, not really a big name, actually, in the whole business. But he is a plot device. He does a good job with the character that won the Oscar, but we don't really learn anything about him.
You know, he has fun with it, and he's very entertaining, but the only character that we really delve deep into is Max. And you're right, he's this complex, flawed character. He's the viewer's proxy, because he seems to be the only sane voice in a sea of insanity. He views everything from something of a high horse, despite being so far from perfect.
Definitely.
It's somewhat silly when you reason that he's arguing against staying competitive. Even though, as they point out, he was just as guilty of focusing on the stories that would keep people tuned in rather than informed. He's just railing against the standards being lowered yet another rung, and he can complain about Diana being the TV generation being obsessed with her job. But he's obsessed enough with his job to not give up even though he has all these moral objections. He just stays and he kind of keeps on. Or he leaves his wife for Diana.
Yeah.
He's played off to be this kind of smug, judgmental one. The one who's better than, better than everybody
else.
Those
New York liberals!
You're right. He is probably the worst of the bunch because he should know better. He gets some of the best lines.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. His two scenes with his wife, Beatrice Straight, has one main scene. She's in the movie a little bit more than that, but essentially it's that one big scene. And she's great in that. She won the Oscar for supporting actress for, I don't know, a few minutes with the screen time.
It's like 5.5 minutes. It's the shortest screen time to ever earn an acting Oscar. Mm-hmm.
And it's the breakup scene that they have. Then when he breaks up with Diana later on, it's another great scene. And you know what's curious about that? Much like Raging Bull, the boxing scenes in that film are justifiably lauded and famous. The mad as hell scenes in this movie, the television working scenes are very famous in this film. But the most effective ones are when you're at home with these people. When he breaks up with his wife, then he breaks up with Diana. In Raging Bull, a lot of people don't like these scenes, but I think they're the most effective ones in the whole film, when he's dealing with his brother and his wife in their home life, the kind of stuff that no one would ever see with Jake LaMotta. And with Max in this film, it's deadly serious. There's no laughs when he dumps his wife. There's no laughs when he dumps Diana whatsoever. This movie, I said last week, should have been on the comedies list, and we laughed plenty. I certainly did. I think it should have been top 100 comedy. But it is extremely dark. Not that that makes it not eligible for the comedies list. But interestingly, the IMDb doesn't even list it as a comedy.
That's crazy.
It's a drama.
It's really very funny. But comedies can have drama. And it's intentionally over the top. So I would classify it as comedy.
Yeah, but usually the IMDb will include any possible category that a movie ranks into. Some movie that I'm a fan of, I can't remember at the time what it is, I think has four different categories, maybe even five categories. Maybe, you know what? It may be Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which we did for the Not 100 last year. So Network should have been listed as a comedy. But off the beaten path with that, I like that element that this is a movie about television, blatantly about television. Most of the scenes are set in television studios or they're talking about the topic of TV. Yet the best scenes to me are in people's apartments.
So you talked about the scene where he's breaking up with his wife. This is a pretty famous scene. Every time I watch it, I find it a little frustrating. And everybody lauds it as this comeuppance, you know, this put-upon wife gets to give it to her husband. But really, she gives it to him for, like, 2 minutes. And he just takes it really stoically. Like, he's not really even affected. He's just taking his lumps, and then he can go.
The last thing she says to him is that you're in for a lot of trouble, Max. I know. Which isn't, like, her blessing, but it's essentially her saying, I'm not going to punch you in the face for doing this.
She's almost trying to comfort him. It looks almost as though she's forgiven him for everything inside that 1 5-minute scene. It's a little frustrating because one thing you could criticize this film for is that Max really gets off the hook. Yeah, he suffers through the course of the film, but...
At the end, he's back with her. He's going back to her. Yeah. And she's probably going to take him back. Maybe that's it. Maybe she knows that she's going to win him in the end anyway. I mentioned Raging Bull, another Scorsese film that also starred De Niro. Goodfellas, Karen Hill at one point goes over to the woman who's banging her husband and yells and screams at her through the intercom. And then she says in a voiceover there in the film, why should I let her win? She's not just going to give up. Maybe Louise, Beatrice Strait, is of the same opinion in this film.
She says the strangest thing. She says, I'm not going to give you up easy, Max. Mm-hmm. You should move out.
Maybe she means money-wise.
Yeah, I guess so. So we're kind of dancing around what is probably everybody's favorite thing about this film, which is the screenplay. It's definitely the star of the film. It has that great erudite wordiness, and amazing actors just love to sink their teeth into this stuff. You would call it Sorkin now, but I suppose Ed Sorkin actually mentioned the screenwriter.
Is Sorkin an adjective now? Sorkian?
Have you never heard that?
I guess I am now.
Yeah, I'm coining it.
Yeah, a guy who writes TV shows about TV.
Yeah, that's true. Which
we didn't like very much.
But he has, like, people speaking impossibly intelligent sentences at breakneck speed. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you can't call this film inspired by Aaron Sorkin.
I like Sorkin a lot, and he's a very talented writer. But I would say this screenplay is way better than anything he's ever done, including The Social Network or A Few Good Men.
And when he won the Oscar for The Social Network, he thanked the screenwriter of Network, Paddy Chayefsky, or mentioned him in his speech.
A movie that's mostly about dialogue also and people sitting around in rooms talking. I guess most movies are really all about people in rooms talking anyway. Even the Godfather films are mostly about that.
Yeah, but most people cannot be one-tenth as articulate and clever as the characters in these films, which, you know, it's unrealistic, but it doesn't matter because it's just so delightful to watch.
David Mamet, Kevin Smith, well, Smith's not on their level, but all these guys, Tarantino as well, they write speeches for people that most human beings don't ever say.
Yeah.
And when I mentioned speeches, that reminds me of some of the reviews of this film. Vincent Canby and Roger Ebert, they raved about this movie back in 76, but the infamous Pauline Kael didn't. She thought it was self-righteous, and she didn't like the long speeches.
Her criticism, and it's shared by a lot of people, is it's just so smug. We all relate to Schumacher, who's just so very much above it all, despite having made his living shilling the same slightly less offensive garbage for his entire career. And it rubbed people the wrong way. I enjoy television. We all have our guilty pleasures.
We watch a lot of TV.
We do watch a lot of TV. And
there's a lot of TV to watch, though.
And TV is different. The TV we're watching is probably very different from the TV they were making there. But we also make TV. You're in 24-hour news, and I'm in entertainment news. There are not two more vilified types of brain drain garbage that we're kind of taking part in making. We can say from the insider's point of view that this movie's not that far off. The way that people are just so callous and pragmatic behind the scenes.
Sidney Lumet is on the DVD, the commentary, the making ofs, all that stuff. I have heard him say these two words probably 40 times in different interviews now, that the movie at the time, 1976, nearly 40 years ago, was not satire. It was sheer reportage. If that's right, and if that was true then, it is remarkably true now.
Yeah, it was really prophetic. When you read the bad reviews at the time, some people, like Pauline Kael, didn't like it, and a lot of people thought it was hyperbolic. That was their complaint. They're like, this is ridiculous. This is way over the top. This would never happen. And I know that this hasn't literally happened, but is Howard Beale that different from Glenn Beck?
I can't believe that no one has ever been called, in reality now, a mad prophet of the airwaves, like Howard Beale is called in this film.
And like with pride, to intentionally get ratings and get attention.
Rather than in an ironic kind of way, as in this film. The one thing Lamette talks about that hasn't actually happened in real news is that someone's been murdered on camera, especially a news host. And he's right, that still hasn't happened even now.
It was inspired by an actual on-air suicide of a news reporter. I don't think that it was planned or announced, but Christine Chubbuck in Sarasota, she, I think it was with a gun, she shot herself on air. And it was on live TV in 1974, and people saw it at home.
And that's deadly serious, but one of my favorite moments in this movie, and this maybe should inspire the top 100 quotes line, along with the very famous "I'm as mad as hell" scene, when he says, "I'm going to kill myself in this broadcast."
10 seconds to break.
The assistant director in the newsroom. And nobody hears him say it.
One guy's like, "Did you hear what Howard just
actually,
said?"
Actually, ironically, it's her. I actually thought about this when I was compiling my notes after the movie's over. It should have been somebody else. Because she's the one that has that great moment. They have this shot going through the newsroom showing him saying this line. The camera's behind her, so it's, "I'm going to kill myself." 10 seconds to commercial. But then she's the one during the commercial that says, "Did you guys hear what Howard said?" Should have been somebody else. Maybe it would be more effective. But then the director and the switcher, people in the business know what that means. The producers, nobody seems to have picked up on the fact that this guy just said. They're not listening to him at all.
No, they're busy. You know what it's like. You've been in those
and I can attest
before,
to that, yeah. Because I've talked about this movie a lot of times. There are three movies that people who go into the business that we're in have to watch. This is the first one. Broadcast news is the second one. And whether you like it or not, Good Night and Good Luck is the third one. And there are many others you could watch, too. Actually, The Insider. I would actually maybe include that one now.
You just named two movies I've never managed to watch to the end.
Well, you should.
Yeah.
The Insider is about 60 minutes, as much as it is about the cigarette scandal. So for people in our business, you watch those films, and when you do what I've done before many times, where you're doing production, you don't really listen to what they're saying. You're not supposed to be watching what they're doing. You're not supposed to be hearing what they're saying so much, especially when you did what I did for so long, which is the switcher, the technical director, or for the audio guy. Ironically, even the audio guy probably doesn't really hear what they say. You don't process it, at least.
Yeah.
Because when you go home, people will always ask you, especially when you do what I've done for all these years I've been at the CBC, and they'll say, "What's in the news today?" And a lot of times I've had this answer, and I know my friends have too. "I don't know." Because we weren't really watching it. That's not what we're supposed to be there to do. And also, one thing I can definitely say is very true now, is I tune it out because I can't take it much anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm mad as hell, but I can't take it much longer.
Yeah, something that they don't necessarily blame their disconnection on is you really do just get overkill when you work in the news. And you get gallows humor, and you have to remain distant from it because otherwise it would drive you absolutely insane.
A friend of mine who still works at the CBC, he has a theory that a few of us who work directly for a news network have gone a little nuts because of the content. And we're not blaming anybody. This is what you got to show. It's no one's fault.
It's like being a cop, emergency trauma surgeon person, or something. Yeah, it does actually affect the way you see the world.
Okay, so this movie told the future and how appropriate there's a soothsayer in it. The other thing I wouldn't have known was so true when I was only 2 years old is that business, oil interests in particular, and big conglomerates were such a key part of everything. And we're already swallowing everything up. We know that Time Warner bought CNN a long time ago. And Rupert Murdoch, with his Fox Enterprises, bought nearly everything out there. And other companies have, too. It's not just those guys. GE bought NBC. But this movie is the mid-70s. And business interests, the Saudis, CCA is the big company. They're dealing with them. This deal has to go through. And much like The Insider I mentioned a few minutes ago, when it comes to what they're doing in network and the news of the movie, you can do what you want and say what you want to an extent. But don't you ever fuck with the business of the company that actually owns the network.
You can tell people to literally get up and turn their televisions off right now, but if you tell them to send a telegram to the White House trying to stop this business deal, like that's when he crosses the line and that's when they start meddling with him.
And the only time we see Ned Beatty in the whole movie, he has one scene. We said Beecher State has about 5 minutes and one big scene. Ned Beatty has only one scene in the whole film. He was on set for one day, his last AFI film, and maybe in a way his most memorable performance.
I mean, come on. Yeah.
That He's great in that.
Amazing.
Another actor who's acting in the movie.
Oh.
It's almost like he prepared that. It's almost like he had to rehearse it for days before.
Sure.
"You have met with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale, and you will atone." Am I getting through to you, Mr. Beale?
He sets the stage. The lighting is so dramatic, but when they come into that room, the lights are off, but all those lamps are on, and he closes the drapes. He is creating a theater.
A set, yeah.
Yes, a set for him. I don't know if it was a feature of the script trying to mess with the audience, or if we're supposed to believe that somebody told Ned Beatty what Beale said that God said to him.
He does say it on the air. Beale says in one of his broadcasts, because I thought the same thing, how did Jensen, that's Beatty's character's name, know Beale had a vision of, maybe not God, but of a big power telling him what he needs to say? He does say that on the air at one point.
But he makes this whole scene to convince Beal that he's God, and it obviously works. I love he has all the lights illuminating his face. He kind of looks like Satan at the end of that long tail. Yeah. There's supposed to be this kind of road to hell, and the camera's at a low angle. It's very diminutive. But he comes around eventually, and then his face is completely obscured by darkness. It gets covered up by lamps. And what is he talking about when his face gets covered up? He's talking about how the power of corporate leadership...
There's no countries anymore.
There's no... Yeah, the elimination of nations is going to create a future without war or famine or oppression.
Which is so untrue.
It's so untrue. It's such a ridiculous notion. And that is when he becomes obscured, because that is when he's just bald lying.
And as much as we said that Max is very culpable in this because he knows better and they all actually know better, Jensen knows more than even Diana or Max ever do, blatantly, in that moment. I am manipulating this guy, and fuck him, because he's my puppet.
And maybe he's just like Diana. They both seem to have no conscience about what they're doing. They're just these pure, hyper-competent business people.
And Howard is too crazy at that point to even realize he's being manipulated the way he is. So he right away goes on the air and starts talking about how, no, I was wrong about that. Don't meddle with CCA, and that's when they start losing ratings, and that's what gets him killed later on. Although Jensen becomes his biggest supporter of all at that point.
Yeah, but not big enough to save him.
No. It's funny we're talking about Ned Beatty so much right now because he's not in the movie all that much. He has a smaller role than he did in Nashville, bigger than he did in All the President's Men, and more important. And yet his character is kind of the Emperor in Star Wars the whole time. CCA has owned this network, and what is the network called? Made up one.
UBS?
UBS. Okay. They are effectively Fox News because in the late 80s, when The Simpsons, Tracy Ullman, Married with Children... Cops, I believe, is a Fox show. Mm. When that started getting to be a big network, that was the fourth one that actually happened. UBS is fictional. We said that this is Fox News circa 1976. Well, Fox as a company didn't even exist then, but around 10 years later is when they got their foothold. When it comes to entertainment, they've done a lot of great things, but of course, most people that we know would agree that Fox News is never doing anything right, it seems. And this movie shows that even 4 years ago, I guess this has been true for a lot longer than that, actually, but money does indeed rule absolutely, positively, everything.
There are no nations. There is Exxon, GE.
It's funny how the news used to be above all that stuff. It wasn't supposed to be about a profit maker. It wasn't supposed to be about anything to do with anything other than to present the facts.
That's a naive statement.
Supposed to be, I said.
I think it's gotten worse.
I didn't
worse.
Say that it was that. I said it was supposed to be that.
Well, it's still supposed to be that. It just fails worse at being that.
And it isn't just Fox. We've been ripping on them. They're terrible. I think they should be off the air. Well, no. Sorry. They shouldn't be off the air. They should have their right to say what they want to say. But people should be smarter than to buy into this crap. And they should try to watch all sides as much as they possibly can. And more importantly, use their own heads.
And hold them to higher journalistic standards. All journalism should be held to higher standards. There should be worse consequences for straight up lying to your viewers.
The company I work for, I think, is better than Fox News by a country mile. The CBC, I think, aims for better journalism. I know they all think that they do much better than that. But because of budget cuts, we're having to settle for a lot less because we can't literally afford to do stuff the way we could anymore. That's what a public broadcaster has to deal with. Mm-hmm. But even before all that happened, we would have that stupid and pointless story on there. News is hard. It's horrible, especially now, probably more so than it was in the mid-70s, even though the Vietnam War wasn't long past, even though Watergate certainly hadn't passed by very many years at that point. Those two things were very fresh in people's mind. We talked about that plenty last week in All the President's Men. And awful things in New York were going on. Taxi Driver points that out. That movie's not a documentary, but it seems to be pretty accurate for the time. And yet, now there are ongoing wars every fucking where.
Yeah, when Network came out, it was responding to the fallout of the 60s, Vietnam, Watergate, and audiences must have been absolutely primed for something this cruel and bombastic to just put words to their frustrations. And it's this large, unapologetic rage that's being expressed, and it must have been cathartic for people.
And that's where the line comes from. I'm as mad as hell. I'm not going to take this anymore. Misquoted often. I'm not going to take it anymore, but this anymore. And he doesn't really mean anything specific. It's more about how, stop screwing with us, the little people.
Yeah.
And I always find that funny, incidentally. This maybe wasn't so true in the mid-70s when a news person would do okay for himself. He might have a nice Manhattan apartment, but he wasn't rich. But a lot of people who claim to be journalists nowadays are stinking rich by any normal standards. And I said it last week in All the President's Men, referring to the paper, the movie that Ron Howard made, where, here's an interesting link, Robert Duvall's character, as the editor of the whole paper, talks to Glenn Gloss's character, who's the managing editor, you can't live like a star. You work in the media, you can't live like that. And yet that's the way so many of them are now. They are stinking rich, and that's one of the biggest problems I think that exists in the whole world. There are a thousand things we could say that are wrong in this world right now, but the way that the media does their job or doesn't do their job is absolutely one of them, because they're too mixed up with the idea that they're going to make money too, and they won't tell the truth because that affects their bottom line, because it affects their boss's bottom line, and I can't do that. And how about the serendipity of this? The same day we watched Network, we saw a Larry Wilmore episode, The Nightly Show, where it's about corporate preachers. That is remarkably wrong. I don't want to get too far in religion and all that stuff, but if you're going to try to counsel people about something that's bigger than all of us, at least in these people's opinions, faith, that should never be about making money. And there are people out there who are making millions and millions of dollars on the backs of their parishioners, and that is remarkably wrong.
And Network wasn't just criticizing the people who are making this TV. It definitely trains its eye on the viewer. It definitely is criticizing John Q. Public.
Why are we watching this bullshit? In,
the people who are standing out on their fire escapes yelling, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it
And that's
anymore.
All they're probably ever going to do is say that.
Yeah, the people who are just that easily influenced. And those are the same kind of people who are sending $300 to some preacher because he literally is straight up asking for a private jet. They're that gullible. And I mean, we're all guilty of it. This is part of what people didn't like about it because they probably saw themselves in that criticized mask.
That's not me. Well, yeah, it probably is all of us in some way.
Yeah.
And the same day we record this podcast, we watched a Vice episode that's all about global warming, which has become a contentious issue, which it shouldn't be contentious at all.
Mm.
And a small part of that movie, at least an underlying theme of that, is that politicians and the modern news media, particularly our friends at Fox, are misleading people about what's going on in the world in a way that affects everybody on the planet, especially people who live anywhere near the ocean.
And if you want to see an interesting microcosm for everything that can be good and bad about media, look into Vice. Vice is one of the few enterprises that seems to be doing really serious journalism. Very
remarkable
aggressive.
Downer, too.
Yes, yeah. Where
but that's
not,
what it has to
yeah,
be.
Yeah, but they also have this really terrible reputation for how they treat their employees and take advantage of people. Like, and Shane Smith is so rich. He's worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
But
he's
you know,
gotten very wealthy.
But that place, and what I've said to you before, that if somebody invents a way to have fresh water for everybody in the world and they make trillions out of that, give it to them. If somebody solves the problems we have with things like global warming or any of the hundreds of other things you can name in the world right now, and they're the Koch brothers and they make trillions of dollars, give it to them. Give it to her. Give it to the big group. I don't care.
Yeah.
Fine. If they're actually going to do something that benefits people, then let them make profits. That's what capitalism is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be about Sheldon Adelson will determine where we all go because he runs casinos.
What
the fuck is that guy determining the Republican Party for? He runs casinos. My God. We're more political in the TV podcast than we were last week about the Nixon-destroying podcast last week, All the President's
this
Men.
This is probably the worst political rant we've ever gone on.
We're our minutes away from watching Vice.
Yeah.
We're only a week away or so from watching that corporate preacher's thing, so I'm pretty fired up right now.
Okay, I'm going to talk about the movie again. Let's talk about something else this movie addresses, which I don't think a lot of people talk about, but it's kind of an important part of the movie and something I always find personally fascinating, is the conflict that goes on between generations. You have Max and Beale, who are the members of the greatest generation. Then you have Diana, who's really the only representative of the baby boomers. And everything that they find wrong with her seems to be everything that all the baby boomers currently find wrong with millennials. So don't worry, millennials. Don't let them get you down, because someday it'll be you making fun of your children. But it must have been a really tremendously satisfying movie for all those members of the greatest generation who were watching the baby boomers take over their positions of power. And it's a very generous to that instinct we all share to lament about the good old days and revile the youth coming to take our place. And it appeals to that desire that we have to feel ever so slightly superior to everyone else, particularly the next generation coming in to ruin everything. Ironically, the smugness that these characters and surely the viewers of the movie are indulging in is the same smugness that makes us tune into Jerry Springer or Hoarders, shows that would have been surely created by somebody just like Diana Christensen.
Yeah. Well, one thing about this movie, when it's all over, at least the Mao Zedong hour lives on.
It sure does, and it's making bank. To the delight of the communists.
Just give her the fucking overhead.
How can you not call this a comedy? Oh my God.
Well, it's a comedy. It's
I'm not saying you. IMDb.
Well, just the day before we record this podcast, though, when you talk about the generational gap, a friend of mine who's about 10 years older than me, but he seems to be even older than that sometimes, has that whole sort of, you kids today and your shitty music and your shitty movies and your shitty TV. That's always existed, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, media's not that old. Radio started, I don't know, 100 years ago, give or take, and TV certainly isn't even close to that old. And as the entity that it is now, it's maybe less than 40 years when this movie came out. Newspapers are older. But I'm sure through all that time, and maybe we're even talking back in the era of Caesar and Jesus, all those kids today and their bongo playing.
People thought the Gutenberg press was going to destroy the world, and so, definitely change the world.
The kids always mess with the older generation. If we're still alive in 2070, we're going to hear that from another couple of generations about how that one is worse than the one before, because that's what older people always do.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to avoid that as a 40-year-old person, because I know full well that what Diana's doing in this movie even, although she's not that much younger than me, and the guy she put on the air is definitely older than me, is not even for me. If I was 40 in 1976, even I am too old for that. So when you talk about modern music or modern TV shows, modern movies, I'm not the target audience, and neither are you anymore. I'm sorry to say, honey.
Look, I'm not denying it, but I've always worked in youth television, so I think that's made me a little immune. I don't criticize the younger generation. They're my bread and butter. I gotta try and empathize with them, and I work with a lot of young people, too, so I don't buy into the whole millennials are destroying the world thing.
And that also plays into the whole I'm as mad as hell scene, where all the people get on their fire escapes. Not every one of them, but plenty of those people in that scene look like they're pretty young, in their 20s. Then and now, people could do the same thing. If some guy, if it had been that idiot Glenn Beck, who I think is a horrible piece of shit, but if he had said something like that, and the Fox News viewers had gone out to their front yards and on their fire escapes and said, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore. People were mad then, they're mad now, they were mad 100 years ago, they'd be mad 100 years from now when we're all underwater. But we continue to take it. Because I don't think that really, as a group, we're really doing enough to make a difference in all this kind of way, because we do keep watching this bullshit. And I try to be above some of these things, but I'm not above enough of these things.
Yeah, the film is kind of talking about impotent rage, because we're all mad as hell, but there really isn't a damn thing we can do about our circumstances, and the circumstances have only gotten worse since then, and people rail against it, and they rage against it, and they protest, and they write blogs, and they complain to each other, and they make podcasts all about what's supposed to be a movie and turns out being about politics.
And ironically, people have more of a voice now by a mile, including, we talked a few times already about Social Network, that's all about Facebook. Talk about a voice that people didn't have a long time ago, and yet we have less of a seat at the table than we probably did.
Could a Woodward and Bernstein, to talk about last week's movie, could they take down a president?
They'd work for Vice, and they would get attention, but they'd get a minor part of the attention. They wouldn't become national stars, I don't think.
I don't know if a voice is as influential as it used to be, especially the voice of peons like us.
Maybe because back in the 70s, there were three news stations. So that means three main news anchors. And then you had radio and you had newspapers, of course, but you didn't have thousands and thousands of different types of people every day, maybe even millions, but certainly in the thousands, saying whatever they think about any topic. And we're part of that, too. We're part of the problem,
maybe.
True. And everybody gets lost in the cacophony. At least we're talking about old movies. We're a specialized thing. We're not just going on about the news of the day, although we are writing a lot
just
on
today.
This podcast. Technology and the modern era has allowed people to do things they could never have done back in that era of the 70s and even into the early 2000s. I don't think it really has made a lot of difference in many, many ways, though.
You know, you sure can't deny the power of this movie to strike a chord, because look at the conversation it spurred. We're having a really hard time staying on the topic of the movie because it raises so many interesting things to think about and talk about.
Make me so mad!
Mad as hell, one might say.
One might say. All right, well, did you know, loyal listener, that the top-billed actor in this movie, and I think it's the first time in a little while this has happened, is a lady?
I noticed it when we were watching it, that she got the first credit.
I would have thought
it'd
be Holden.
Really surprising.
Maybe
yeah.
Even Peter Finch.
He's probably the star of the film, but I guess she was a bigger star in Hollywood.
Because of Chinatown and Bonnie and Clyde wasn't that long before that. This is her third AFI film. Those two, of course, made the list. And she doesn't die this time. First time she hasn't died on the list. And neither does William Holden. They're in seven AFI movies in total between them, and the only time they survive is one that they share. But as far as Diana goes, she's well played, but I think she's also kind of Nurse Ratched. We learn very little about her, but is there much more to learn than what we see?
Yeah, she's meant to be shallow. She's a caricature, but her performance kind of takes it above caricature.
Oh, it's a great performance,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, because it's just a comedy performance.
Played straight, though, incidentally.
Sure, and the depth of it is that she really has no depth.
Another thing that Lumet says in the making ofs is that if she tries to inject humanity in this, he's going to cut out of the picture.
And maybe he did. I love what was left in. And she kills it. She earned that Oscar. She's absolutely fantastic.
Or maybe she's Patton. She's built for one thing and one thing only.
Yes.
To make television, to win ratings. Is that really what this all comes down to in the end? She's not motivated by money or love or friends. When Max is in her face, that's the most human she ever is in the whole film. She says she's not capable of giving him what he needs. But is he just in this to win? kind of like Gordon Gekko of Wall Street, it isn't about making money so much. Of course, he wants to do that, but it's about winning, and money is just what they use as a score rather than home runs, touchdowns, or three-pointers.
For her, it's ratings, though. She never talks about money. Her house isn't really anything particularly special. She dresses just fine, but her house just looks like the place where she sleeps. I mean, she lives in the office. She lives for work.
Because she just wants to be successful. Yeah. The actress with no soul in this film at least has a lot of it in Bonnie and Clyde and Chinatown. So her resume has been pretty impressive. There's three films, and really the most famous she's made easily, along with, I guess, Mommy Dearest, which is a piece of shit, but she's definitely well-known for playing Joan Crawford in that film, and hasn't done a ton of great films since those three. Kind of like Nicholson, only made three films that made the list, but diverse, interesting. And William Holden, I would have thought the bigger name going into this, but he is second billed. Fourth time we've seen him on the list, the last time we're going to see him on the list. Sunset Boulevard was the first movie, Virgin River Kwai, which we both loved, and The Wild Bunch. Sunset Boulevard was 57 AFI movies ago. And unfortunately for Holden, he died 5 years after Network came out. He bled out from a bad fall while he was stone cold drunk.
Yeah, that's right.
He certainly looks a lot older in this film than he did in The Wild Bunch. And that's A, because he was getting older, but B, because he was not taking very good care of himself. But a great actor. I remember one time Spielberg said Tom Cruise would one day be the William Holden of the modern era. I don't think that's really come true. Cruise is still more of a star, and Holden was a character actor who became a star. Cruise has always been a star from the beginning. But Holden started out as a golden boy, too. He literally was in a movie called The Golden Boy and was kind of coasting on his looks for a long time until he started getting roles with the Billy Wilder films. And for my money, that catalog of 4 AFI films is up there as well. Dunaway's resume, his resume, outstanding stuff. Peter Finch, only AFI movie for him. He died before the Oscars actually aired when he won the award.
Yeah.
He's one of only two people to ever win an acting Oscar posthumously. The other one is quite well known. And who is it?
Yeah, easy peasy. Heath Ledger.
Heath Ledger, not that long ago, actually. And Howard is also UBS's own Frankenstein, an AFI movie we covered a long time ago. He's created by circumstance. I guess you could say Schumacher and Hackett and Christensen all have a play in this, and certainly Beale himself. And then they can't control him anymore, so they gotta whack him.
I don't think you can credit UBS with creating him. He definitely...
They help him flourish, let's put it that way.
Okay. One of the reviews I read pointed this out. When he gives his famous I'm Mad as Hell speech, people remember the film as if that's the first and only time he loses it.
But he's lost it several times.
It's the third time. Like, they just keep putting it back on the air. And did you notice, I love this detail, when he's kind of starting to lose it, he grips the side of the desk, the front of the desk, I should say, and it looks like he's hanging off the edge of a cliff.
Appropriate, yeah.
Yeah.
You leave me alone. I'm not going to leave you alone. First, I want you to get mad. And did you notice when he says, I want you to get mad? Before he says the more famous line, they cut to Diane in the newsroom. Huge smile.
That's the best. Like you said, the expressions that she makes are kind of like the best part of her performance.
As much as any of her dialogue.
There's no conscience. There's no concern about the well-being or the scruples of anything she's doing. She just is so delighted by what she knows will be ratings.
Mm-hmm. The last actor of note, and actually there's a lot of good actors in this film, but the last one we got to talk about is a guy who will also be in Close Encounters of the Third Kind in another small part, but a good character actor for a long time, and he's still working now, Lance Henriksen. He's in that scene where Laureen Hobbs and the great Ahmed Khan are discussing all kinds of business stuff. The pissed off commie N-words. She calls herself, at least. Yeah. She describes herself that way.
The Ecumenical Liberation That's Army, right. Yeah. I think.
We probably should talk more about those people. Hey, another movie with mostly white people, although the TV business in the 70s would have been Lily White. All right, well, the director, Sidney Lumet, his second AFI film, his first was 12 Angry Men, and that was 42 AFI films ago. That's one of the bigger gaps between movies anybody has in the entire list. He did a fine job of directing this film, keeping under the radar, kind of like 12 Angry Men, where there's some technical stuff if you really look for it. 12 Angry Men, the whole thing where the camera is objective, it's above them, and then as the movie gets longer, it gets to be lower, so they're looming over it. In this one, it starts out looking documentary style, and then towards the end, it becomes more of, as he called it, a Chrysler commercial.
He has a great way of letting the script and the actors really shine. That isn't to say that he stands back and lets them do all the work. Definitely not.
He was known for rehearsal. He would do 2 weeks of rehearsal, I think at least that long, maybe even longer, on every movie. And maybe that's why they would have fairly quick shoots. He wrote a great book, too. I think it was called Making Movies quite a long time ago. I remember it being very instructional and very informative.
Yeah, considered one of the best on the topic. One of the most helpful.
And I said last week that Alan J. Pakula kept back in All the President's Men in his style, unlike Scorsese and even Spielberg in the movies before this, Taxi Driver and Jaws. The director was the auteur. These last two movies, the director has been an auteur of not being noticed. You thought that was good in All the President's Men, and I'm assuming you're agreeing with me that in both cases, that's for the best.
Yeah, they're more collaborative than dictatorial.
But also the camera's not flying around everywhere, because it doesn't need to.
Yeah, absolutely.
The writer, Paddy Chayefsky, won 3 Academy Awards, including for this film, also for Marty and The Hospital. And he had a lot of input during production. to the point where I don't think Lumet let him direct the film in any official kind of way, so they didn't have co-director credit. But it was his movie, and Lumet and all the making ofs has always said, this is Patty's movie as much as it is mine. The producer, Howard Gottfried, did The Hospital for Chayefsky, Altered States, which Chayefsky also wrote, and his last credit that I will mention is Suburban Commando, the Hulk Hogan movie. You always love to find those weird dichotomies. I remember that the guy who did the score, Jack Nitzsche, on Cuckoo's Nest had a very unusual three or four movies you could mention that have nothing to do with each other. For the second week in a row, we've seen kind of a spotty DVD print. We're going to see mostly Blu-rays the rest of the project. I don't know if the Blu-ray is any better, but this DVD print was not the greatest. It is a 185:1 film. The cinematographer shooting it, Owen Roisman, did The French Connection and Tootsie, two other AFI films, and The Exorcist. Great resume right there. Those four films, three AFIers. The editor, Alan Heim, who did All That Jazz and American History X. And the composer, not really a true composer. We have a diegetic situation going on here. We had a lot of that more in the early part of the decade, where there was no traditional composer. Easy Rider, American Graffiti, Last Picture Show, they had music that was actually in the movie on jukeboxes and cars radios and that kind of stuff. Commercials in this case, TV commercials with network, but Elliot Lawrence technically gets the credit if there is any really for any kind of composer. And he was a musical director of a lot of the Tony Awards. The influence. I don't know that there's a ton, actually, as much as we both love this film. The main ones, one we've hit on too often already in this podcast, reality TV, Fox News, the media in general. And that may be as big as any influence we've ever had in some ways, though, beyond film into the actual culture.
Well, we've talked a lot about Sorkin. I think that screenwriters would probably argue that this film was pretty influential because it was over the top in a way that many writers and actors love to indulge in, but in a manner that was really palatable to audiences.
I happen to be reading the trivia about This Is Spinal Tap earlier tonight. Major rock stars, The Edge from U2 was one of them. And Ozzy Osbourne was another one who didn't get that it was a comedy. I guess to them it was too real. And maybe network's the same thing. People watch this and think, yeah, that's my business. Why are people laughing? Even then, let alone now.
No, that can't be because you and I are in the TV business and we find it funnier than anybody. Maybe, we were cracking
maybe
up.
Maybe in spite of ourselves.
So did The Edge actually think that all those drummers died? Was
No, I shouldn't say he thought it was real, but he could relate to the fact that this wasn't just silly comedy. It was something he must have seen. Well, we keep talking about Aaron Sorkin, but I guess the biggest inspiration on a major modern filmmaker is PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson. He's a huge fan of this film, and he said that in Magnolia, we talked about that last week when we did All the President's Men, because Jason Robards won the Oscar for playing Ben Bradley in that film, and then 33 years later, he's dying on a bed in Magnolia of cancer, his last film, and he did die of cancer in reality, too. And PTA said that the Earl and Jimmy characters in Magnolia were based on the TV characters in this film. It's like if they had grown up to be people who were on the mortal edge of cancer, because they both get that, and they're kind of reaping the shit that they sowed in this era. I don't think that Magnolia and Network are all that connected as far as style goes, but as much as he's always raved about how much he loves Altman and makes that pretty clear, and obviously Scorsese too with his camera techniques, Network is the movie I think that he seems to revere as any other, and in that one case, based it on this one. Okay, a very small awards section. It did win the four Oscars, and as I said last week in All the President's Men, that's more than the Best Picture winner, Rocky, which only won three. The four were four. Best Actor for Peter Finch, Best Actress for Faye Dunaway, Supporting Actress for Beatrice Straight. One of only two times that three actors have won awards. What's the other one? Do you know?
Oh, was it...
One of your favorites.
Guess?
No, nope, no. That's no. Not Much him. Older than that.
Oh.
A streetcar named Desiree.
Of course.
Everybody but Brando. And in this case, it was everybody but Beatty, because he was nominated for supporting actor. The other win, though, was for original screenplay for Chayefsky. The six nominations that didn't win, pitcher and director, and I heard that Sidney Lumet was pretty upset that the movie didn't win Best Picture. I don't know if he was that bothered about him not winning for directing, but he was pissed off that Rocky won over this.
Competitive year.
Mm-hmm. Holden was nominated for Best Actor. I think he probably should have won over Finch, but he had won before at least, and Finch dying maybe was a factor in that whole thing.
Oh, sure, sure. The movie really lets them just eat the scenery in a way
Finch,
that's
for sure.
Fun. Finch, definitely, and Faye Dunaway, and Ned Beatty. Those are the performances that the Academy likes to reward because you can see them working
You're
so hard.
You're seeing the strings. Yeah, yeah that's yeah. true. It's kind of funny that Tom Cruise has never won because of that because you always see Tom Cruise working so hard.
Tom Cruise has never won because his thetans aren't aligned.
Oh, that's going to happen one day, though, yeah, I guess, yeah. Millions or even billions of years in the future, yes. I guess, yeah. When volcanoes explode or something. Yeah.
Yes.
The other failed nomination is supporting actor for Beatty, the editing, and the cinematography by Roisman. Network made the National Film Registry in 2000. And the famous line, we've said it plenty already, I'm as mad as hell, I'm not going to take this anymore, was 19th on the top 100 quotes. Peter Finch recorded himself reading the newspaper, and when Lamette heard that, he thought, okay, there's my guy, because he tried to keep his accent from getting in there. But if you listen, and I don't really care, I think people get stuck on this whole accent thing too much, but anymore, he says anymore, and he says other things, you can hear the accent creeping through, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, the other two lists it didn't make for the top 100 laughs, what the fuck, and Diana is a top 50 villain. All right, this has been as political as any film we've ever covered. I didn't think it was going to quite go that way, but I blame Vice and I blame The Nightly Show for being fresh in my mind when I took notes and then when we record the day of.
I blame you and your tendency to occasionally go on tangents.
Never. So, okay, it rose a little bit on the list, but still in the mid-60s both times. Would you put it higher? I'm assuming you put it on the list, period.
Well, I think the way that it's been so thought-provoking and conversation-provoking is proof that it's a good movie, and it's proof that a film doesn't need to be perfect. Yeah. To be great. Time has shown it to be a classic, period. I hope it keeps climbing the list.
If the AFI ever does another top
yes,
list.
Yes, yeah. I just always assume that they will. It's wishful thinking, perhaps. But.
Okay, well, the next title on the Top 100 Project came out almost the same exact time as Network, and it is 1976's monster smash hit that you may have heard of, Rocky.
This movie I have never seen. Mm-hmm. This is the movie that when I tell people I've never seen it, they're so alarmed, like even worse than The Sound of Music. People have so passionately recommended Rocky to me over the years. I shouldn't keep my expectations too high. But there's definitely been a lot of anticipation on my end to see this movie.
I think you might like this more than you expect to.
I expect to like it.
But it's not really about boxing.
I know. I expect to like it. I'm sure I'll like it.
Okay. It is technically a sports movie, though, and that does play into the coming attractions trivia, which is, along with Rocky, what's the only other AFI movie that made the top 100 thrills, was in the sports category of the top 100 genres, and won the editing Oscar?
Oh, come on.
If you know the AFI list, it isn't as hard as you might think.
Alright, so for the answer to that question, please tune into next week's podcast. If you'd like more trivia along with lots of other fun stuff from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. You can email us, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And we'd like to once more warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
I just hope this podcast isn't taken off the air because of lousy ratings.
And cut.